This podcast of Word of Mouth is sponsored by
Doucette Survey,
serving your professional land surveying and mapping needs in New England,
now with offices in New Hampshire and Maine.
Information at doucetsurvey.com. That's doucetsurvey.com.
And
Northeast Credit Union, helping their members save money
through free checking accounts and refinancing of auto,
home, and personal loans.
Northeast Credit Union, encouraging you to discover the difference at necu.org.
Federally insured by NCUA.
Equal housing opportunity.
And Dartmouth-Hitchcock.
Creating a new model for healthcare,
where leading health systems collaborate to improve care for all of us.
A sustainable system
improving the health of our communities
for years to come.
Information at imagine.d-h.org.
Word of Mouth.
Word of Mouth.
Word of Mouth.
Word of Mouth.
Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Shortly after a grand jury in Ferguson, Missouri, decided not to charge a police officer of wrongful death in the killing of Michael Brown, comedian Chris Rock tweeted this: "Just found a new app to tell you which one of your friends is racist. It's called Facebook." The joke hit home for many Twitter and Facebook users. Reasonable people who would avoid topics like the grand jury decisions in Ferguson or Staten Island or immigration or the Gaza conflict at the dinner table or in the office break room wound up in the middle of bitter exchanges and unfriendings over these issues on Facebook. WNYC's New Tech City podcast devoted an episode to this issue with personal stories from listeners, along with practical advice on what to do when your Facebook friend says something racist. Here's our conversation with host Manoush Zamarodi, who joined us to talk about it just before the new year. Manoush, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thanks so much for having me, Virginia.
Manoush, let's begin. You put together a little montage of people affected by this issue. Let's hear from them.
My story is that I had a friend that I worked with.
I recently had a dialogue on Facebook with a friend of mine about immigration and executive orders.
One of my elementary school friends who I grew up with posted a story about hair salons accepting EBT cards.
And it just got really uncomfortable because the posts he was making were about Hispanic people, and I am married to a Hispanic man.
And some of her friends started to chime in, and they made fun of African-Americans on the way that they spoke and how they were going to get their hair did.
A friend of theirs, whom I didn't know, interjected a picture. And this was a photo of our current president.
By the time they got to the whole Chinaman thing and doing the nails, I just said, you know what, this is just too much for me.
A noose was photoshopped in, so now it looks like someone's putting a noose around his neck, and it was entitled, "Hope on a Rope. It's what everyone's been waiting for."
Now, I no longer see racist comments on my Facebook page because I deleted my Facebook page.
So a couple things come up for me here, Manoush, starting with why these kinds of offensive messages turn up on Facebook. You know, it's not fully anonymous like internet trolling. These are family, they're colleagues, they're people you went to school with.
Well, that's the thing, though, right? Some of them you know incredibly well, very intimately. Other people are sort of people you met once. Maybe you thought you clicked, and so you friended each other. And yet, Facebook has become a place where people feel that they are sort of anonymous because they don't have to look anyone in the eye to say something like this. And once one comment, maybe it's not explicit, but sort of has an undertone of racism or sexism or classism or whatever it might be, people just sort of go with it. A lot of people either they decide, you know what, I'm not going to listen to this, and they unfriend it, like the woman you heard, Tamika Cody. Or maybe they just think, oh, this is normal, and it becomes normal, and it becomes part of the feed, and no one really stops or does anything about it.
Well, I hear from them, as I've heard from people that I know, an element of surprise or unawareness that one of your friends or even your aunt or uncle or somebody might post something that's so offensive.
Well, it's shocking, right? Because, like you say, it's not something that would come up in polite conversation. And yet, when things get heated, when it comes to politics, when it comes to racial discussion, people say things that maybe they wouldn't say at the dinner table. And yet, so I think that's what we found, Virginia, was that people were struggling. They were surprised. They were shocked. And they also didn't know what to do because on the one hand, you don't want to deal with that. But on the other hand, if you unfriend someone, doesn't that just make your Facebook feed or whatever social media you're on, if you unfriend people or stop following people who think differently than you do, surely that makes it a more homogenous feed. I mean, we know that, I think there's a study that came out that said for white people, most of them, 91% of their social circle is also white. 83% for black Americans, they average a social circle that's 83% black as well. So we know it's a pretty homogenous group that we put around ourselves in real life. And so, you know, we actually asked Facebook, do you know what the racial composition is of Facebook, of people on Facebook? And they told us that they don't track the racial composition of people's friends on the social network in any way. But they did tell us that in the 24 hours after the Ferguson grand jury decision, 11 million people had 33 million interactions about Ferguson on Facebook. It's a lot of interaction. Yeah. A lot of ideas, thoughts, opinions flying around really fast. Maybe people not thinking totally through how they should put perhaps a somewhat divisive comment forward, or just not thinking at all.
Well, you brought up so many interesting things, but I remember seeing a study. Now, this was from last year, finding that Facebook is a particularly powerful medium to spread racist messages. Why is that?
Oh, yeah. So we talked to Shannon Rao. She's a social psychologist at Benedictine University in Illinois. She did a really interesting study where she created a fake Facebook guy, white guy, and she sent it out to several hundred people. She sent three different messages. So one of the messages was, you know what, we still have a long way to go with discrimination. Another message was overtly racist about white supremacy. You know, at first, participants agreed with that first message, and they really rejected the overt racist message. You know, so that's a relief, right? But then she sent out a third message, and this third message, they called it the victim message. And in this message, the writer talked about why whites are the most oppressed group in America today. Now, so it wasn't, you know, as overt or nasty. It was sort of a different angle, and they found a very high level of agreement with the message, particularly among people who use Facebook very frequently, who really use it to be part of a community. So, you know, wedged between sports scores and gossip, the sort of less obviously racist message wasn't flagged. People just kind of went with it. And Shannon Rao's point is subtle and just not saying anything. That's actually very powerful when no one flags something, when they just let it go by, when they let it seem normal. I also particularly found it interesting that it was the people who spend a lot of time on Facebook who were the most likely to agree with it, not the person who sort of pops on occasionally to get some information. And you know, and it made me depressed because it made me wonder if finding a community online can mean losing the ability to think critically. You know, that was the sort of worry that I have. Yes, it's depressing that we do create a homogenous society for ourselves off and online. But then, so surely a place that could be more sort of racially diverse, you know, online, we're not doing that, and we're sort of letting things slide as well. And that was, you know, our listeners really wanted help with, like, so what do I do? Like, how do I cope with this? Do you just, like,
well, yeah, because
it or not.
Because if people don't let it slide, I mean, well, here are the choices, right? Unfriend, ignore, or hide. Yeah. I've noticed some people just hiding posts or posts that I've hidden myself. Or confront, which sometimes means adding fuel to the fire. You're jumping into the fray. Isn't that something that should just be done privately?
Well, so that's, you know, and I have to admit, like, that is usually my MO as well, you know, which is like, well, I thought I liked this person. Now I don't. Moving on. Mm-hmm. But on the show, we also talked to DeWitt Campbell. He's a social service worker, a dialogue facilitator for the National Conference for Community and Justice in St. Louis itself. And they actually have created something. It's sort of like a formula with how to talk to people about touchy stuff. And he's said that, you know, he's so interested to see that he actually thinks their formula works better online. So let me just tell you a little bit about it. It's called LARA. It's an acronym. L-A-R-A. So L is for listen, A is for affirm, R is for respond, and A is for add. We have actually a handout for Laura on our website at newtechcity.org. But what I can tell you is that it takes time to be a good interactor. It takes time to not just unfriend, but to engage someone. It is not a quick process. And it also means not reacting in the moment. And what DeWitt told us is, like, that's the beauty of Facebook, though. You can walk away. You can walk away. You can sleep on it and not respond until the next day. So maybe, you know, yes, it's fast on Facebook, but maybe we should be going, like, maybe there should be a slow Facebook movement. I don't know.
So your Facebook friend said something racist. Now what? That was the title of a recent episode of the New Tech City podcast from WNYC. We're talking with Manoush Zamarodi. She got several personal stories and heard from several suggestions and got some data on what to do when somebody says something racist on Facebook, and she's sharing that with us now. But here, I'm thinking about something that you said earlier, that we're living here in New Hampshire, right? And it's a homogenous population. Mm-hmm. But of course, we're aiming at dialogue. And Facebook gives many of us access to a national conversation or mm-hmm. an international conversation. Should we be even making observations without any experience of that or any context?
Yeah, you know, it's the double-edged sword of social media, right? On the one hand, your voice counts just as much as anybody else's, and that's a beautiful, beautiful thing. On the other hand, we often say things that we haven't really totally thought through or done the research or even considered how somebody else might feel about it. And I think what we're doing and what I hope to really explore is we're in a new world when it comes to dialogue. How do we keep it civilized while furthering the conversation? How do we maintain our humanity while we're all yelling at each other and these ugly, horrible things are popping up? And I think we were just sort of going with it right now. Mm-hmm. Maybe it's time to like use the most recent news events to sort of pause button here. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Let's just take a minute.
Well, yeah, because unfriending or ignoring means ultimately, that could just have a chilling effect on the conversation, you know, discouraging people from dialogue or sharing their opinion, which we do inside of our own little holiday party gatherings or water cooler conversations about it. Yeah. Facebook is one of the few places we venture outside of the bubble. So how do you nurture conversation and make it helpful?
And, you know, actually, we commissioned a survey from a market research company named Cervata. They polled randomly 300 Facebook users, and almost a third of them said that they considered blocking or unfriending someone over offensive comments about the news in particular. So not only does that mean that, like, yeah, a lot of people are seeing some nasty stuff, but yes, a lot of people are thinking it's time to cut them off. And we had another person on the program, Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen, and he is a friend of the show and also a black man who has a lot of white friends. He went to a primarily white college. A lot of those people are still. So he was seeing a lot of divisiveness. And he told us that he kind of decided, you know what? I don't unfriend anybody because I want them to all see what each other are posting and then talk about it. He sort of felt, you know, I'm in a unique position of having an extremely heterogeneous Facebook profile. I need to put this to good by educating the white friends who probably have mostly white Facebook how I feel about this. It's my job to tell them. And if I don't, they're never going to know someone who does feel the way that I do.
One of the effects of that is that, you know, yes, you can have those conversations with people who you will not likely see again, who you went to school with, but the others you're going to see at your family holiday party.
Yeah, I mean, that to me is like, yeah, you know, Auntie Jane says something really rude on Facebook and you're going to see her at Christmas dinner. Well, that, I have to say, is where the Laura comes back in. It's time consuming, but the first thing is listening. And even if you think that what the person is saying is absolutely crazy, you have to listen thinking that this is the most wonderful person, the most respected person in my life. I'm going to pretend they are while I listen to what they say, just to get yourself in the mood. Then with Affirm, you find something, anything, anything that you can agree with that Jane says. And maybe Auntie Jane says something like, you know, it's the justice system. We have to leave it to the justice system. And you say, yes, that's what this country was founded on. I agree with you, right? You find that one point. And then you respond. That's the R. You set the tone. You start with that affirmation, and then you start to sort of explain where that has changed and where you find that the justice system maybe went wrong. And then you add facts, statistics, or counterexamples. I mean, that means you need to be a well-educated person who does the reading so that you, when you do decide, yes, I'm going to be one of those people to engage in civilized dialogue and try to explain my point of view, that you back it up, you know? We got to back it up. And my guess is that Auntie Jane, if we keep going with this analogy, that she probably doesn't talk like that at the dinner table like mm-hmm. she might in her Facebook feed.
All right. So I'll be carrying both with me to my next log on Facebook and to holiday dinner. Manoush, thank you so much.
Oh, it was such a pleasure, Virginia.
Manoush Zamarodi, she's host of the New Tech City podcast. That's from WNYC. And there's a link to hear the episode, Your Facebook Friend Said Something Racist, Now What?, as well as the Lara handout that she mentioned. All that, wordofmouthradio.org. How about you? Have you seen offensive racist posts on Facebook? Have you unfriended? Have you hid? We'd like to know. Guess where? On our Facebook page, facebook.com/wordofmouth.
This is when the party ends. I can't stand here listening to you and your racist friend. I know politics bore you, but I feel like a hypocrite talking to you and your racist friend.
Up next, another topic that is typically avoided at the dinner table. For many Americans suffering from debilitating diseases of the gut, fecal transplants offer hope for a cure. The scientific benefits of poop, when Word of Mouth continues.
Listen to some bullet head madness that he's saying. This is where the party ends. I just sit here wondering how you stand by your racist friend. I know politics bore you, but I feel like a hypocrite talking to you. You and your racist friend.
Word of
Mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Well, it's not on the top three list of things that you shouldn't talk about in polite company. Talking about feces probably comes in fourth behind religion, politics, and salaries. However, for a growing number of Americans suffering from debilitating illnesses of the gut, conversations about fecal matter are pretty much standard. Patients desperate for a cure for drug-resistant diseases like Clostridium difficile and incurable chronic diseases like Crohn's and ulcerative colitis are looking to fecal microbiota transplantation as a revolutionary way to reset their own microbiome and potentially save their lives. Emily Aiken is a freelance journalist and former senior editor at The New Yorker. She wrote about the emerging field of fecal transplants for The New Yorker. And Emily, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
So what is FMT, or fecal microbiota transplantation?
Yeah, well, most people call it FMT because it's such a mouthful to say. It's a procedure, a fairly crude one, in which stool is taken from a healthy person and transferred to the colon of someone who is sick.
Okay, so this is done with an incision? How do you transplant?
Actually, that's a really good question because there are various ways to do it, and researchers are trying to figure out what is the most efficacious way to make that transfer. But people have tried nasogastric tubes, enemas, colonoscopes, and even capsules, which in the field are called crapsules of stool, as ways to get it into a sick patient.
I guess I'm not the only person who's immature about this. But what's transplanted? What does it do?
Well, it turns out fecal transplantations are the chief medical application we have right now, coming from this whole new field of science, the science of the microbiome, which is the study of the microbes that live inside us and outnumber our own cells by 9 to 1. Most of these microbes live in our gut. And what the research is showing is that they play a pivotal role in our health and can even be instrumental in treating disease. So our easiest access to them right now is through our poop.
Mm.
So a healthy person is eliminating microbes on a daily basis, most people, and those microbes turn out to be invaluable medical tools for treating certain kind of illnesses.
What's the history behind this treatment?
Well, it's a really interesting history because the first known fecal transplants were done in China in something like the 4th century, where we actually have the first handbook of emergency medicine written by a 4th century Chinese physician. And in it, he mentions administering something called a yellow soup, which was a fecal suspension for the treatment of people who had severe diarrhea or food poisoning type conditions.
Okay, where to go from
and,
there?
Yeah, then it kind of disappears and resurfaces sometime in the Renaissance in Europe. There is an Italian anatomist who writes about what was called transspawnation, which was the use of fecal transplants in veterinary medicine. But there wasn't a lot of talk about using it in human beings in the West until about the 1950s. In 1958, in the United States, a surgeon in Colorado who noticed that his patients after surgery would often contract severe bacterial infections that were increasingly resistant to treatment with antibiotics, and some of them were very, very sick, even dying. And it occurred to him that he could try implanting healthy stool into their colons and as a possible treatment. He was desperate. And what he did was go to a nearby maternity ward where he knew there were young, presumably healthy women who had avoided antibiotics because they were pregnant. And he had a resident take stool from the maternity ward, bring it back to his surgical unit, and administer it to his patients. Dr. Eisman published 4 case reports at that time recounting the rather miraculous recovery of 4 of these patients who had received fecal transplants. Virtually within hours, they had recovered. And nobody picked up on this until, maybe the last 10 years or so, when simply the motive was simply more and more people, typically hospital patients, coming down with these antibiotic-resistant bacterial infections. And there was literally no obvious medical treatment. So in desperation, going through the case histories and finding Dr. Eisman's accounts led more and more doctors to think that they should try to do stool transplants.
How do hospitals and doctors obtain the material now that is then transplanted?
The new thing, the new source of access to stool in the last couple of years has been this stool bank started by a couple of graduate students at MIT.
Oh, this is the open biome that you write about? What's the story there?
The story there is a graduate student at MIT named Mark Smith had a friend who had contracted Clostridium difficile, and his friend was young, in his 20s, an otherwise healthy man who needed to go to the hospital for gallbladder surgery. And when he came out sick with Clostridium difficile, and he underwent round after round of antibiotic treatments for his condition. He failed to improve and was at a certain point was unable to maintain his job. He was that sick. And had read about stool transplants, couldn't find a doctor to do one, eventually found a doctor who was at least willing to research the procedure, but was basically on a wait list for 6 months and ended up giving himself a stool transplant at home using his roommate's stool. So his friend, Mark Smith, thought this was just outrageous, that a treatment that was pretty universally available and known to be effective for the treatment of this particular condition was just so hard to get. So Mark Smith recruited a friend to help him start a stool bank modeled on a blood bank. The idea was, well, gee, these are young guys. They're at MIT. They know a lot of other healthy young researchers. They'll recruit them to provide stool anonymously. They'll screen these people, make sure they're healthy, make sure that their stool has no pathogens in it, and then they'll sell it just at a very low price to cover their costs, to hospitals and clinics where these sick patients are.
We're speaking with the writer Emily Eakin, who wrote for The New Yorker about a controversial medical treatment called fecromicrobiota transplantation, or FMT. She wrote about the procedure and some of the patients who have benefited from it quickly and markedly. Do I dare ask how one does a DIY fecal transplant?
Yes. So first place the route to go is to the internet. There are literally dozens of how-to videos on YouTube that'll walk you through the equipment you need, how to do it at home, who to get your stool from. And then there are also support groups on Facebook where people who have done this, you know, trade suggestions with other people who want to do one. So there are sort of these underground networks for DIY fecal transplantation.
Well, any risks? I mean, any kind of DIY health procedure or medicinal procedure could have some risks, right?
Absolutely. So it's a little alarming that people are resorting to these DIY methods, and there have been a lot of anecdotes of people even using their pet species when they were unable to find a donor. Some real eyebrow-raising stories. However, the interesting thing is, for the most part, there have been very few reports of adverse events. There have been a couple of case reports of people contracting a virus or an infection following a fecal transplant. Whether it was directly tied to the fecal transplant hasn't been proven. But, of course, there are risks, and that is why doctors and the FDA stress that one should always be screened before you donate your stool to someone, or if you're a patient, before you accept a stool donation. You want to make sure the person you're getting stool from doesn't have a transmissible disease.
How effective is the treatment for C. diff patients?
It is. It's incredibly effective. Doctors are amazed when they did the first randomized controlled trial involving fecal transplantation. The trial was published in January of 2013. Over 90% of the people who received a fecal transplant, as opposed to the standard antibiotic treatment or a placebo treatment, recovered. That's just a really high figure in medicine. I'm told that nothing in medicine has a cure rate of over 90%. And in fact, the trial was stopped early because it was determined that it was unethical to continue when the patients receiving the transplant were doing so well.
Huh. Are there other diseases that might be candidates for FMT?
Yes. Yeah, so the field has moved on now from Clostridium difficile to looking at autoimmune diseases are a big subject that people are investigating. And, of course, that includes a whole host of conditions. The most prominent ones among autoimmune diseases that are likely to benefit are ulcerative colitis and Crohn's disease, but people are also looking at conditions like allergies or autism. Children with autism have often horrible gut imbalances, microbial imbalances, and there have been case reports, again, just anecdotal at this point, no rigorous studies, I'm told, of children who've been treated with fecal transplants who also have autism and who recover verbal faculties following the treatment. So there's some tantalizing preliminary evidence that this sort of treatment is likely to benefit other conditions.
Well, it just sounds like an amazing story. But why do you think, Emily, it's such a challenge to get treatment for patients? I mean, is it about people feeling uncomfortable talking about poop?
Well, you know, it's interesting. I read that there's one study that it was really a survey of patients and physicians that found that the biggest obstacle to treatment was not the patients, but the physicians. The patients who were candidates for fecal transplants quickly overcame their reflexive revulsion at the idea. It was the physicians who thought, gee, this is messy and disgusting. I don't really want to be working with poop. But apparently that attitude is changing. And Open Biome, the stool bank, is growing at something like 18% a month in terms of its clientele. So it started out with just a couple of clinics and hospitals, and now ships stool to 36 states. I mean, that figure is now a month out of date, probably. That's probably changed. Mm. So I think fecal transplants is increasingly big business, and I think it's available just about in any big hospital in this country. But I think it's also worth saying that a fecal transplant is still a very crude procedure. We don't know which microbes in our guts are the ones that are truly beneficial. So you get them all when you get a dose of stool. Mm-hmm. And in the future, the treatment is likely to be much more streamlined and concentrated. So the 15 really effective microbes for your condition will probably be filtered out into a pill that you swallow.
Well, Emily, what a story. Thank you very much for joining us.
You're welcome.
Emily Egan is a freelance writer and former senior editor at The New Yorker. You'll find a link to read her article, The Excrement Experiment. It's at our website, wordofmouthradio.org. Sleek cancer treatment facilities are mainstays at today's hospitals, offering state-of-the-art technologies and treatment options. But in the late 1800s, you'd be hard-pressed to find a hospital in the United States willing or able to treat a cancer patient, let alone design a building for the specific purpose of treating people with cancer. Roman Mars' podcast 99% Invisible looks back to the early days of New York's premier cancer center.
This is 99% Invisible. I'm Roman Mars.
I am walking down 106th Street.
That's producer Jessica Miller. Jess used to live near Central Park, and she's been walking by this building and wondering about it for a long time.
The address of the building is 455 Central Park West, and it looks like a castle. It's huge. It takes up the whole east end of the block. It's made up of red brick with this intricate stone trim, and it's got five or so large cylindrical turrets with silver cones on top. The building has been renovated, but when it was built in 1887, it was the country's first hospital devoted solely to the treatment of cancer. And it turns out that was a pretty common style for hospitals of that time.
They looked like castles. They looked like aristocratic mansions. And we see in the architecture that they're walled, they have gatehouses, they have elaborate entries, sometimes turrets. They have all the trappings of a very, very wealthy neighborhood. They're very domestic in their architectural outlook.
That's Anne Marie Adams.
Hi, I'm Anne Marie Adams. I'm director of the School of Architecture at McGill University.
She's also written about hospitals from this time period, and she says that in the late 1800s, hospitals were charitable institutions run by wealthy philanthropists where poor people went for care.
Rich people still mostly received care at home, but hospital administrators wanted to change that.
Architecture is a tool of persuasion to convince wealthier people to come to the hospital to be healed.
So in 1887, the first cancer hospital opened its doors to both paying and non-paying patients with cancer. And it tried hard to be an inviting place for paying customers.
Champagne parties, carriage rides through the park.
Even the food was good.
So they had great chefs. You know, part of being competitive was having really good food. People went to hospital dining rooms to celebrate special occasions like birthdays. Like we might today go to a hotel dining room, even though if we're not staying at the hotel. So that obviously has changed a lot.
The hotel comparison is pretty spot on. The cancer hospital was designed mostly for palliative care. In other words, just making people comfortable and relieving pain.
Beyond palliative care, the main treatment for cancer at the time was surgery. But surgery for cancer was still incredibly primitive.
Surgeons from this time were doing pioneering work, and patients were pioneering guinea pigs. This was before the time of antibiotics, so a lot of people died from infections after surgery. But desperate patients take desperate measures.
Things were bad, and they stayed bad for cancer patients for quite a while.
It wasn't until the 1930s or so that things started to improve.
In 1939, the cancer hospital left 455 Central Park West for the Upper East Side, where it became Memorial Sloan Kettering, which is now known as one of the best hospitals for cancer treatment in the U.S.
And of course, hospitals don't look like castles anymore. After World War I, hospitals start to look like
small civic institutions, more like city halls or schools. They're very square. It's called the block plan.
And we said goodbye to good food, champagne, and carriage rides.
The money was channeled in things like surgical suites and in mechanical equipment.
After World War II, the office building / skyscraper becomes the model for hospitals.
It all changes again in the 1980s with the onset of what we call patient-centered care, where the Atrium Hospital just takes off.
These are hospitals that look like shopping malls. Just one or two floors, big open spaces.
I mean, that's a very kind of capsule history of the 20th century hospital.
As for the castle-like building that housed the first cancer hospital,
now it's 17 condo units, a parking garage, a spa, a pool, and a fitness center.
The hospital castle on the park finally became on the inside what it always pretended to be on the outside. A nice place for rich people. 99% Invisible was produced this week by Jessica Miller and Katie Mingle, with Sam Greenspan, Avery Truffleman, and me, Roman Mars.
We are a project of KALW and distributed by PRX. More at 99pi.org.
Coming up, if you're new to Twitter or just want some fresh voices in your feed, stick around. Brady Carlson is going to review the year on Twitter and offer some advice for Twitter feeds to follow. That's when Word of Mouth continues after the break.
Word of Mouth.
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 Word of
Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Twitter is bigger than ever and can no longer be accused of being solely a media echo chamber. Looking back at last year's biggest Twitter stories, we're reminded of elections in India and Brazil and protests in Hong Kong and the hashtag Bring Our Girls Back campaign, all of which provided a glimpse of what the world was talking about outside of our own little routines and obsessions. Twitter feeds are now incorporated into news stories and voting referenda and activism and memorials and, of course, the Ice Bucket Challenge. Brady Carlson is host of All Things Considered at NHPR. He's an avid tweeter and consumer of tweets who everybody should be following. Brady joined us just before the year's end to suggest some feeds to follow that are off the beaten path. Brady, great to have you back.
Thank you. I like to think of myself as not only a Twitter follower, but a leader of Twitter followers.
Good to know. Well, Brady, you got to sell me on Twitter. I mean, I have to say, I find it much harder, much more overwhelming to sort of break into the Twitter sphere than I do on Facebook.
I think, as you said at the beginning, it's so almost institutionalized now. Every news organization has it. Every public figure, politicians, comedians, TV shows, writers, everybody's on Twitter to at least to some degree. They have a presence there. And while that's cool in a way, it means that you're not going to have a shortage of people or organizations that you might want to follow and keep in touch with. I think it does make it tougher to find those nuggets of creativity, those really unusual serendipitous moments that used to be so much more prevalent on Twitter.
Well, for me, Facebook has become this medium where I can actually follow people and know about their lives, which I think is important, and they can know about mine. I mean, I had a really tough year. My dad passed away last month, and a lot of people following me on Facebook knew that. I would run into them. They would know what was happening. I don't feel like I have any instinct for what's going on in my personal life, especially on Twitter, because I won't get the responses. So, of course, it's all about the responses on some level.
The dynamic is different, and a lot of that is just the interface. When you go on Facebook, you're presented with what your friends are doing, and it's much more about having the relationships that are very distinct to you and very close to you. Twitter is more about being a droplet in a larger river, or an ocean even, of information and ideas. It is a place where I find more often than on Facebook or other social media sites that I will find something that is going to be bubbling up, not to overdo the water metaphor, but it's where I'm going to find instantaneous information. It's where I'm going to find sort of the latest ideas that people are going to be talking about. And then oftentimes I'll see a tweet containing a link to a big idea or a news story. And then a couple of days later, I'll start to see the discussions filtering out on Facebook about that same idea or that same story. Mm-hmm. So it's a not as intimate as perhaps, say, Facebook, but it's intended to have this more immediate effect on people and users.
So given that I'm going to ask you about who to follow on Twitter, and those accounts may be followable for no more than the next 5 minutes because Twitter moves so quickly, how did you decide on which Twitter feeds to recommend?
Well, what I was aiming for was to try and find things that are not obvious. So I tried to come up with Twitter accounts that would introduce people to new ideas. I also want to provide a caveat that these are not comprehensive by any means. Twitter is a global thing, and there's so many interesting accounts that are going on in other parts of the world that it would take us months and months to try and do a comprehensive job of introducing people to all of those.
Okay, so with those criteria established, let's start with some that have actual news value, let's say in the traditional sense.
Well, I tried to come up with ones that had good context around them. Somebody who might fill you in on some of the background. There's a historian who mostly focuses on presidential history, but he talks about all facets of American and world history. It's Michael Beschloss. He's written a number of books. But on Twitter, he's become quite adept at finding the historical artifact, the photo, the item that has something to do with the news of the day. So when the news broke about Cuba and the U.S., he found a photo of Vice President Nixon and Fidel Castro in the day, back in the Cold War, and just providing one of those moments. Anytime there's a news story going on, it's not simply just an on this day in history kind of feed, which is what's interesting. I've often heard it said that history is the story of the present told through the past, and his feed really exemplifies that. And you see the effect on that in institutions, museums, historical curators are all trying to do that now, what Michael Beschloss has been doing for some time.
That's Michael Beschloss's Twitter feed. We're going to post the entire list. I don't know if we're going to get to all of them today, Brady, but we will have those posted, the entire list posted at wordofmouthradio.org. Any others for real news or, you know, stuff that makes you really think?
I want to recommend a former colleague of mine. He now works at public radio in Boston, but our former colleague, Will Roselip, as far as I can tell, I'm no expert, but he is the most interesting voice in classical music that I've seen yet.
And here's really? What I knew he was a cellist. I had no idea.
Here's what I mean by that. He is convinced that the biggest problem in classical music today is the way that we discuss classical music, that it's sort of shunted off into concert halls and presented as this very difficult thing to approach. And he's made the point that our frame of reference for classical music is way off. When you think about so many of the viral videos that we've seen over the years, you know, you've seen the group of cellists who, you know, will put that spontaneous concert together in the town square, or the violinist Joshua Bell showing up in the subway station and anonymously playing for people. There are these classical music videos who show up everywhere, even the videos of that group Two Cellos, the mm-hmm. two guys who play AC/DC songs through cellos with distortion pedals and fireworks and things in their concerts. There's a pop culture element of classical music, he's saying, that we are completely overlooking because we think it's stuck over in the concert hall. And he's saying all we have to do is start thinking about it in a different way and we'll start exploring this music again. Because classical music, as he puts it, used to be the music of the people. It was the folk music of its time.
It sounds quite sincere. He's on a bit of a mission. How about all of the sort of funny and phony and fakish people tweets that we see online? Any in that category come up?
There are so many. A couple worth recommending. There's one called Upworthy Spoiler. We've talked about Upworthy, the clickbait site, as it's derided as, or Upworthy will give you those headlines like, that ton of food your schools throw away? How about doing this instead? And they want you to click on it and share it with a million people. Upworthy Spoiler is a Twitter account that spoils what the clickbait headline is withholding from you. So for that ton of food your schools throw away, how about do this instead? Upworthy Spoiler posted, donate it to soup kitchens, because that's what you'd find if you went and clicked on the article. So they go through these pieces and find the answer to the clickbait question.
You don't even need to click through.
That's right. And what happened after I checked out that Twitter feed changed everything.
Brady Carlson is with us, who keeps a keen eye on the social media and news media universe. We're talking about some of his picks for those to follow on Twitter. There was one that you shared with me recently, TV Network Notes, which showed an almost prescient kind of way of communicating now that we've seen all those leaked Sony emails. What was
this? They were really ahead of the game on this one. These are purported to be actual notes from network executives to TV show producers and creators that are beyond the pale. For example, the cable channel True TV said, quote, "This show needs to make sense to someone who just looked up from taking a bong hit." That was apparently the note they gave to a producer of a show. There's one for that the people who created The Walking Dead on AMC said, They had pitched the show to NBC before ending up on cable, and they were told, apparently, "This is awesome. I really love it. Does it have to have zombies in it?"
So the phony Sony, I guess, on some level, TV Network Notes. Another that you shared with me previously was TLDR Wikipedia. Now, what's that? Too long, didn't read.
Too long, didn't read, right? That's a long-time acronym on the web. But TLDR Wikipedia is essentially like a one-sentence version of what you might find in a Wikipedia article. But, of course, they are all pretty clever ways of summarizing the pieces. So, for example, there's "a font is a style of typeface carefully chosen to make your English teacher think a paper is 5 pages long."
I really liked "male pattern baldness is a condition which, if left untreated, eventually results in a new Corvette."
Or there's this one here in public broadcasting. This might hurt a little bit, but it says, "Ken Burns is what happens when a PowerPoint gets funding from the Kellogg Foundation and viewers like you."
Okay, and then, of course, there is the personality-driven Twitter feed. Now, you didn't give us Taylor Swift or Beyonce. What have you got?
There are a couple of different personalities. I tried to find people who I thought were going to say things that were going to be a little bit outside the norm so that you would get a different perspective. For example, there's a writer named Casey Johnston who writes about tech, and she writes about feminist issues in tech, which has been a big issue, especially this year with Gamergate and some of the other issues that have come up. She wrote a piece about how tech diversity has been affected by the decline in AP computer classes in high school, so that if you're not having people get involved in these things at an early age, then you start to see that later on down the road in higher education and then in the workforce. She started getting these tweets back from men, not realizing that she had written the article. So they would say things like, "You know, you need to read this whole article to really understand what's going on." And she would write back in these very effective Twitter burns, "I wrote the article." So she's a voice, I think, that we hopefully will hear a lot more of in the coming year. Another one is, his name is Michael Twitty, but he's best known for he has a fantastic Twitter handle. Kosher Soul is his Twitter handle. His blog is known as Afro Culinaria. He is a culinary historian. He studies the history of food, in particular the history of food talking about enslaved people. And he has a perspective that is just fascinating when you talk about some of the issues that have come up in the news this year about something like Ferguson or Eric Garner in New York. He can take a broad approach rather than people sort of reacting just to the minute of what's going on at that very moment. Taking a look at the issue of race in America, which is as elemental a question as you can get in American history, and taking a look at what 300 or 350 years of these conversations look like and how it might apply to today. And he does it through the lens of food, which is genius. I mean, one, he knows his stuff. He's a very interesting cook, and he goes for the absolute most authentic way of cooking dishes that are several hundred years old, the same utensils, the same exact types of vegetables and meats and so forth. He also gives people a way in who might be uncomfortable talking about it through the usual channels of criminal justice or politics or the economy. He's able to take it through food, and food is a thing we all have in common. We can all get into some complex issues when we talk through food, which is fascinating.
Brady, I'm thinking, you know, what about people who aren't on Twitter when they hear all this? I mean, you don't need to actually be on Twitter to follow these feeds. That's one thing we should make very clear. People can go and look at them. But who are you following on Facebook?
Well, right now, I would recommend, this is actually nice because it's local, I would recommend the Mount Washington Observatory. They post, obviously, weather data and information like that, but they're photographs are fantastic. And Facebook has become increasingly visual over the last couple of years. They've made photos a lot larger. They used to be tiny. And now they're a huge part of the screen real estate when you visit Facebook, whether that's on your mobile device or whether it's just on the plain web browser. And they look great. The information is great. They're very shareable. And they're just very fun. They're clearly very enthusiastic about what they do for a living. And it's something that you can enjoy even in the coldest day of the coldest part of the year, which is clearly what we're headed toward in the immediate future.
Well, Brady, thank you so much for making me a little bit more excited about Twitter. I'm going to go back to your water metaphor and think of a Chinese proverb that I once heard. Oh, little drop, give yourself up and gain the ocean. Is that a way to get to Twitter?
It is. And it's very tweetable, too. That's not even 140 characters.
Brady, what's your Twitter handle?
At Brady Carlson.
Brady Carlson. He is NHPR's All Things Considered host. We'll have Brady's full list of Twitter feeds to follow at wordofmouthradio.org.
Because like I've only been on Facebook for a month and we just got rid of my space.
Finally.
You tell me that I should be signing up. Maybe it's the latest way for hooking up.
Really?
You sure it just won't be gone in a month? No way. It's texting, it's blogging, it's Facebook, but better. Tell me what you had for breakfast. Bad jokes, celebrities, and politics. We are never, ever, ever getting rid of Twitter. We are never, ever.
Thank you so much for your listening time today. There's plenty more to hear at wordofmouthradio.org. You can also follow us or send us your feedback or share your ideas for the program on Facebook and on Twitter. And while you're there, let us know who you're following on Twitter this year. Or if you're not there yet, are you willing to start? Why don't you share your story? You never know what kind of helpful or inspiring things you might learn about by word of mouth. I'm Virginia Prescott. We resolve to keep passing them along in 2015. Until next time, this is Word of Mouth. From New Hampshire Public Radio.
Word of Mouth is produced by
Taylor Quimby,
Logan Shannon,
and senior producer Maureen McMurray.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals
and not those of NHPR,
its board of trustees,
or its underwriters. Word of Mouth is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio.